Hi, everybody. It is time for your favorite Sun Sounds of Arizona show, Points of View. This is the voice of your volunteer reader, Robert Rosen. And on today's show, we're going to be reading from the September 2024 issue of The Atlantic Magazine. And there's another show that features The Atlantic Magazine. And that reader reads from theatlantic.com and the short, more recent articles from their publisher. So we're going to read from the magazine itself. And these are a few of the shorter, but they're feature articles in this issue. This first one is headlined, American Fury. For years, experts have warned of a wave of political violence. We should prepare for things to get worse before they get better. It's by Adrian LaFrance. Convulsions of political violence have a way of imprinting on the national memory. They become, in retrospect, the moments from which the rest of history seems to unspool. Yet they are forever intertwined with the possibility that things could have gone exactly the other way. What if becomes a haunting question. What if Franklin D. Roosevelt's would-be assassination had hit his target in Miami in 1933? What if John F. Kennedy had foregone the convertible ride in Dallas in 1963? What if Martin Luther King Jr. hadn't walked onto the balcony of the Lorraine Motel in Memphis in 1968? What if the bullet that pierced Ronald Reagan's lung in 1981 had been an inch closer to his heart? What if Donald Trump had shifted his weight just before a gunman shot at him during a rally in Pennsylvania in July? What if? Maybe it is the collision of malice and luck that makes the outcome of an attempted assassination seem simultaneously fated and wholly random. But political violence is rarely random. In fact, those who study the subject most auspiciously have been warning Americans for years that threats of violence are escalating. Our experience of political violence, the shock of an assassination attempt, how the smallest details suddenly burn bright with meaning, can obscure its true nature. Violence intended to achieve political goals, whether driven by ideology, hatred, or delusions, is broadly predictable. The social conditions that exacerbate it can simmer for years, complex but unmysterious. Again and again throughout history, and indeed today, periods of political violence coincide with wealth disparity, faltering trust in democratic institutions, intensifying partisanship, rapid demographic change, and an outpouring of dehumanizing rhetoric about one's political foes, and soaring conspiracy theorizing. Once political violence becomes endemic in society, as it has in ours, it is terribly difficult to dissolve. Difficult, but not impossible. As I wrote in the New Anarchy in April 2023 cover story for this magazine, political violence is seen as more acceptable today than it was a decade ago by nearly every measure. Political conversation borrows the rhetoric of war. People build their identity not around shared values, but around a hatred of their foes. A 2023 UC Davis survey found that a small but concerning segment of the population considers violence, including lethal violence, to be usually or always justified to advance political objectives. More Americans bring weapons to protest than they did in previous years. A growing number of elected officials face harassment and death threats, which has prompted many capable leaders to drop out of politics entirely. Officials at the highest levels of the military and in White House told me repeatedly that they believed the United States would see an increase in violent attacks as the 2024 presidential election drew near. Other experts talked about pronounced danger in places where extremist groups had already emerged, where gun culture is thriving, and where hardcore partisans bump up against one another, especially in politically consequential states such as Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Arizona, and Georgia. Clearly, they were right in their warning. They further predicted that the current wave of violence would take a generation or longer to crest. Our informational environment threatens to accelerate outbreaks of violence. Social platforms are optimized for rhetorical warfare. Their algorithms reward emotional outbursts, wild speculation, and unchecked hostility, all of which drive engagement with websites that profit off user attention but profess no real commitment to accuracy. Some of the most powerful people on the planet, the billionaire Elon Musk, various members of Congress, stroke contempt for their political adversaries, real and perceived, and encourage legions of followers to distrust the independent sources of information that try to hold them accountable. Periods of political violence do end, but often not without shocking retrenchments of people's freedoms or catastrophic events coming first. As I've previously written, governments have a record of responding to political violence brutally and in ways that undermine democratic values and dismantle individual civil liberties. And political leaders are frequently complicit in perpetuating political violence, seeking to harness it for their own ends. I first became interested in political violence around the time of the Waco, Texas massacre in 1993 and the bombing of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City in 1995. In the years that followed, as the millennium drew to a close, the furies that particular era appeared to cool, which I took as a sign that something had gone right. One scholar of political violence cautioned against such optimism. The militia movement waned very quickly in the 1990s, not because of anything we did, but because of Oklahoma City. Carolyn Gallagher, who spent 2 years tracking a right-wing paramilitary group in Kentucky, told me, after the bombing, extremists went underground, but only for a time. William Bernstein, the author of The Delusions of Crowds, put it in chilling terms when I asked him whether he thought January 6th would be a turning point away from violence in American politics. The answer is, and it's not going to be a pleasant answer, the answer is that violence ends if it boils over into a containable cataclysm, he said. What if, he went on, I almost hesitate to say this, but what if the rioters actually had hanged Mike Pence or Nancy Pelosi on January 6th? I think that would have ended it. I don't think it ends without some sort of cathartic cataclysm. I think, absent that, it just boils along for a generation or two generations. There are poisonous days in our nation. It is reasonable to worry that the attempt on Trump's life represents not the end of a cycle of violence, but an escalation in an era that has already seen a congresswoman shot in a supermarket parking lot, a congressman shot while playing baseball, and the U.S. Capitol stormed by insurrectionists. Some degree of cynicism is understandable, but too many Americans are allowing political exhaustion and despair to justify their own abstention from self-governance. Too many believe that screaming into the void or clicking the like button amounts to political involvement. The only way to minimize further bloodshed is to choose leaders at every level of society who reject political violence unconditionally in word and in deed. This does not mean acquiescing to both sidism. You can still oppose Trump's authoritarian impulses while condemning the attempt on his life. Making it through this dark time does, however, require articulating American values worth preserving and building consensus towards reaching them. And it requires understanding the deleterious effects of political violence. Bloodshed begets more bloodshed, and a functioning democracy can only withstand so much of it. There are no random acts of political violence in America or anywhere else. This would be violence in our nation. There will be violence in our nation until Americans come together and say enough. And that was American Fury by Adrian LaFrance from the September issue of The Atlantic Magazine 2024. Well, that was interesting. Now, this is in the September 2024 issue of The Atlantic, and it is headlined, How Greed Got Good Again. In HBO's industry, Gen Z reveals itself to be just as money-obsessed as the corporate raiders of Wall Street, by Spencer Kornheiber. The question before the room was how much blood the banker should bleed. Mickey Down and Conrad Kay sat in an editing bay in Cardiff, Wales, scrutinizing footage from the third season of Industry, their HBO drama about the drug-addled, oversexed employees of a multinational financial firm. They'd paused on one particular shot of a character realizing that his nose had sprung a leak after much snorting of powders. The blood had been added digitally, and it fired down straight and steady from the character's nostril like a burgundy laser beam. The 35-year-old Down, wearing a Nike zip-up vest and thick tortoiseshell glasses, stroked his chin. The blood was looking a little too gruesome. We just want it to be noticeable. It's a geyser at the moment, he said. A producer noted his feedback, and another unpaused the footage. The next shot revealed that the banker had been cradling a newborn baby in his arms, and that the blood had splattered onto the infant's neck. The image and the writer's matter-of-factness in discussing it caused me to gasp. Down gave an apologetic chuckle. We're sort of numb to it, aren't we? He said. The 36-year-old Kay, the quieter and wryer of the two men, murmured, It doesn't register. It referred to the depravity of industry, a study of lethal greed and ambition transmitted from one generation to the next. When the series debuted in 2020, it followed a class of new hires at the London offices of Pierpoint, a fictional competitor to the likes of J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs. Young and diverse in race, sexuality, and class, the protagonists entered a century-old institution at which culture change, an attempt to build a kinder, more ethical workplace, was supposedly afoot. Rather than upending the system, however, the new hires proved quick studies at old-fashioned self-dealing and backstabbing. Industry has been praised for turning the jargon and technical intricacies of high finance into gripping entertainment. The show is also unmistakably a product of its time. Its pacing is as frenetic as a TikTok binge, and its plot lines touch on Brexit, meme stocks, and in the upcoming season, green investing. Because of the show's sharp-witted, slickly produced treatment of money, privilege, and existential emptiness, some critics have anointed it as heir to the HBO's Succession. But where Succession is fundamentally a family saga about the jaded rich, Industry focuses on fresh converts to the savagery and excesses of the business world. In that, it feels spiritually more akin to grandiose send-ups of the 1980s. Corporate boom times, Wall Street, American Psycho, Glengarry Glen Ross. It's like those predecessors. Like those predecessors, industry can't help but glamorize the very milieu it's trying to skewer. Today's young adults, so often stereotyped as quiet quitters and socialist revolutionaries, driven by idealism and fixated self-care, may seem a far cry from the suspenders-wearing yuppies of the Reagan era. Industry, though, argues that the Wall Street mantra, greed is good, is very much alive and well. In Down's view, the typical Gen Zer is a mini Margaret Thatcher. He added, "I don't even think they consider it like capitalism. It's just securing the bag." The inspiration for industry came more than a decade ago when a 21-year-old Merrill Lynch intern who'd reportedly worked for 72 hours without rest died of an epileptic seizure. It is possible the fatigue brought about this fatal seizure, but it's also possible that it's something that just happens, the coroner said. The then BBC executive Jane Tranter read a news article about the incident and was horrified. This was a few years after Bear Stearns collapsed, and the ensuing crisis had thrown a harsh light on the win-at-all-cost ethos of high finance. Tranter told me that he had wondered, after the disaster of the 2008 financial crash, why the fuck would anyone choose to go and intern in any one of those banks? Then she found two aspiring TV writers who'd done just that. Down and Kay had met as undergrads at Oxford, where they bonded over similarities in their backgrounds. Both men were raised poshly, but their immigrant mothers, Kay's from Poland and Down's from Ghana, preached the importance of proving one's worth with a paycheck. As Down puts it, the immigrant mentality is almost a sort of euphemism for capitalist. When recruiters from the big banks came to campus, the two friends applied for jobs. It felt like it was expected of them. Down remembers thinking, what the fuck else am I going to do? Down landed in mergers and acquisitions at Rothschild & Company, Kay in equity sales at Morgan Stanley. They turned out to have little aptitude for the work. Both of them left within 3 years with dreams of making it in the entertainment world. But they did feel, for a while, seduced by the intensity of the roles provided. "I was really proud of my Morgan Stanley bag," Kay remembered. "I'd take it into a bar. I'd be like, look at me. I'm such a big swinging dick." Big swinging dick had been a prized title for high earners on Wall Street, at least since its appearance in the 1989 book Liar's Poker, in which journalist Michael Lewis described the fraternity-like antics he'd witnessed at Solomon Brothers. When Kay and Down joined the workforce in early 2010, they quickly found that despite the recent financial collapse, the BSD ethos was still going strong. "You came into contact with people who had been there literally since 1982, Down said. "They were all stuck in their ways. They were not going to change at all. And just as the old modes of doing business remained intact, plenty of retrograde views did too. The moment a woman turned her back, everything was about sex. What she looked like. What was she wearing? Who fucked her? Who would fuck her? All that sort of stuff," Kay said. "And weirdly, a lot of misogyny was from the very senior women." When Down and Kay set about making a series inspired by their time in finance, they quickly realized that they wanted to dramatize the experience of fresh-faced newcomers adapting to an institution that refuses to evolve. The denizens of Pierpoint know that at times we're supposed to be changing. In one scene, the foul-mouthed treasurer Rishi announces in a tone of mock triumph, "Bullying has been eradicated from the culture." Nonetheless, during the first season, the recent college grad Yasmin is targeted by her boss in a sexist tirade at a work dinner. That boss ends up taking a leave of absence and apologizing. Yet, as Yasmin rises in the ranks, she pays forward her abuse to colleagues in subtle but still horrifying ways. That Yasmin doesn't look like her tormentor is the point. Previous portrayers of high finance emphasized it as a patrilineage. In Wall Street, the rookie trader Bud Fox idealizes the diabolical Gordon Gekko as a sort of man he can aspire to become. But industry reveals, in the complexity of mentor and mentee relationships in a workplace shaped by overlapping social and demographic waves. In the first season, Harper Stern, a Black American trainee at the bank, finds her allegiances torn between two bosses. Daria Greenock, a white millennial fluent in the rhetoric of corporate feminism, and Eric Tao, an Asian American Gen Xer feared for his ruthlessness. Both try to woo Harper with identity-based overture. "People like us, born at the bottom. We intimidate people here," Eric says, posing himself and Harper as fellow outsiders. Ultimately, though, Harper doesn't seem to feel sentimental affinity towards any of her elders. All she shares with them is a thirst for winning, and so she strategizes based on who has more clout in the corporate hierarchy. Mahila Harold, the actor who plays Harper, told me how she thinks about her character's dynamic with Eric. He's like, "Ugh, I'm seeing myself in you," and she's like, "Ugh, I would like to see myself where you're sitting." Some viewers may be tempted to wonder whether Down and Kay have gone overboard on their cynicism. But just this year, a 35-year-old Bank of America associate who'd reportedly complained about 100-hour work weeks died of sudden heart problems, recalling the sort of tragedy that inspired industry years ago, and that was dramatized in the show premiere. No definitive link between the employee's workload and death was determined. Surveys of generational attitudes about money and work suggest that growing up amid the chaos of inflation, crypto, and a pandemic, not to mention the constant conspicuous salesmanship of online influencers, has encouraged, not challenged, aspirations toward wealth among young people. A recent New York Times article reported that college students are angling for so-called sellout jobs with a zeal that surprises longtime faculty. At Harvard, the share of grads going into finance and consulting is reaching heights not seen before the 2008 financial crisis. And despite industry's disturbing take on the high finance lifestyle, many in the audience have been the opposite of repelled. The creators told me that they regularly hear from new bankers who say that the show inspired their choice of a career. One friend of Downs reported that multiple people in his MBA program had enrolled because they were hardcore fans of industry. Recently, in a West London pub, two young guys approached Kay to express their admiration for the series. They seem like exaggerated versions of the showrunner's earlier selves, two actual drunken, coked up, for want of a better word, morons, Kay said. François Truffaut once said that no movie about war could ever truly be anti-war. History has shown the finance world to be virtually shame-proof. Young bankers have treated Liar's Poker, an expose, as an instruction manual, Lewis has said. Gordon Gekko lives on in a dorm poster symbol of alpha melodon. Even the statistic chainsaw-wielding Patrick Bateman of American Psycho has in recent years been memed as a mascot for the rise and grind ethos that some young men fetishize. Wake up, work out, make money, repeat. So what if a few body parts are slashed in the fridge? Down and Kay understand why finance types love this show. For all its darkness, industry is a pageant of beautiful and superhumanly competent people entangled in slinky romances and high-stakes deal-making. Entertainment about hypercapitalism has to have both the seductive element to it and the warning, Down told me. But the seductive elements include fine cars, expensive clothes, and the freedom to do and say whatever you want as long as you're closing deals. In Wall Street movies, the first act is usually, look how amazing this all is, Down said. And every finance bro seems to just forget about the third act. But the show's deeper appeal lies less in its depiction of the spoils of success than in its dramatization of actual work. Industry seductions and warnings seesaw relentlessly. Each trading floor triumph or delirious night at the club tends to crash into a comeuppance and a monstrous hangover. Even the older, more experienced characters are perpetually grinding, not because they have to, but because they want to. As one billionaire hedge fund manager explains in the show, it's all just a cycle of victory and defeat. The people of Pierpoint are addicted to the cycle itself. Season 3, which premiered August 11th, intensifies that chase to sometimes nauseating extremes. Every time we come back to industry, it's the same, but bigger and more gross, Herod told me. The show is more lucid in tone, more shocking in its twist, and it delivers, as Kay put it, even more weird sexual stuff than before. We just want to throw everything at the wall, Down said. The sweet spot for this show is when people, audience and characters alike, are about to have a heart attack. The escalating grossness is also making a broader point about the stakes of the game that industry's characters are playing. This season focuses on the rise of ESG investments, short for environmental, social, and governance, looking to tout itself as the greenest mega firm in its business. Pierpoint finds a sustainable energy company headed by Henry Muck, a handsomely vapid child of privilege played by Game of Thrones' Kit Harington. In the real world, ESG has been evangelized as a market-driven solution to the climate crisis, appealing to the idealism of younger investors and consumers. It also has been exposed in various instances as the front for fraud, speculation, and the rebranding of the planet's worst polluters. Unsurprisingly, industry's angle on all this proves, in Kay's words, to be the most cynical view you could possibly have. The show makes quite clear that its characters and its institutions they work for are glorified gamblers, and that they've rigged the global casino so their debts get paid by other people. Meanwhile, the lifestyles of the rich and the immoral glitter more than ever. The new episode's setting include a yacht, a private jet, and a sprawling old money estate. Although industry's characters have never been virtuous, the stripping away of humanity, Kay said, is all but total this season. Part of that is simply a function of time passing on the show. The longer these characters remain enmeshed in their work, the more corrupted they become. Eric, separated from his wife and in the throes of a midlife crisis, wins a promotion and gets caught up in toxic C-suite machinations. He realizes that there is always another moral line he'd have to cross to succeed at his job. We really did experiment with, like, what happens if this guy really sells his soul for money, Kay said. What happens if he really keeps making decisions which get rid of his personhood and make him the embodiment of the institution, and it takes him to pretty fucking dark place? At its core, the show remains a portrait of intergenerational continuity, of average, bridging gaps of age and sensibility. In Cardiff, I watched Kay and Down edit a scene in which a veteran money manager lectures Harper about the usefulness of insider trading. He's nearly quoting Gordon Gekko's dictate to only bet on sure things. The elder character, working a necktie while fly fishing, refers to the younger one, who is clad in a leather trench coat and has a nose ring, as terribly modern. The line lands as a joke, though they all hail from different historical eras. These two characters are, in some ways, interchangeable. If industry has a thesis, Kay said, it's that, although social mores change, one generation of animals with an economic incentive is exactly the same as the next. And that was How Greed Got Good Again by Spencer Kornheiber from the September 2024 issue of The Atlantic magazine. And we're a little bit more than halfway through the show, and I just take a little break here to remind everybody that you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is your favorite Sun Sounds of Arizona show, Points of View, and this is the voice of your volunteer reader, Robert Rosen. And remember to download the Sun Sounds of Arizona app to your tablet or your phone. And from there, it's easy to get to go back and listen to this show from the beginning. If you scroll down beyond the live feeds from Tucson, Flagstaff, and Tempe, you'll find this show in the entertainment section. And you can download it or you can stream it right from there. Again, that's the app, the Sun Sounds of Arizona app. Okay, let's now read this from the September 2024 issue of The Atlantic magazine. Does the world need a great American biracial novel? The hero of Danzy Senna's new satire is trying and failing to write one, by Taylor Austin Harper. Early on in Danzy Senna's new novel, Colored Television, her biracial writer, professor, protagonist, Jane, takes a meeting with Hampton Ford, a black producer who is pivoting from network to prestige TV. Jane's situation is less inevitable. Up against a tenure deadline, she has a neurodivergent son, a daughter shunted from school to school, and a tuned-out abstract painter husband at home, as well as a recently completed 450-page second novel that has been unceremoniously rejected by her agent and her publisher. What's more, home for the four of them is the latest in a succession of house-sitting gigs in unaffordable L.A. The family hopes for upward mobility that have been pinned on Jane's promotion to associate professor. No wonder, then, that she has resolved to seek her fortunes in the shadow of nearby Hollywood sign. Her husband, Lenny, calls her opus a mulatto war and peace, and she has come to Hampton's office desperate to somehow salvage the decade of work she's put into it. She pitches him a biracial comedy that will defy the trope of her tragic mulatto, the stereotype's mixed-race character common in the 19th and 20th century literature, torn between white and black worlds, unable to live happily in either. She goes on to explain to Hampton that mulattoes, historically depicted as either dangerously sexual or sad and mopey, have in every case been treated like a walking, talking predicament rather than an actual character. Jane wants to create a show that makes audiences laugh, in which biraciality is more than a woeful burden to overcome or bear with stoic resignation. The Jackie Robinsons of biracial comedies, Hampton jokes after she describes her vision. Colored Television tracks Jane's attempts to collaborate with Hampton on a comedy about the Bunches, a fictional mulatto family that is hotter, hipper, richer version of her real one. The novel oscillates between long passages of largely unproductive brainstorming in Hampton's high-gloss office and scenes from Jane's ever more symbolic personal life. Her son has an obsession with Godzilla. Her daughter refuses to play with a black American girl doll. And she and Lenny have drunk their way through a stratospheric priced wine collection in the too nice house they're currently occupying, courtesy of a friend who is sojourning in Australia. They promise themselves that they'll replace the bottles, well aware that they can't possibly, and that this transgression is a boozy diversion from their sputtering marriage and the receding prospect of middle-class life. And then, of course, there's Jane's novel, a swollen, spectacular thing. She describes it as multi-textual, a chaotic collage of history and sociology, incorporating hundreds of years worth of mulatto experience, real and imagined. She has included a discussion on Thomas Jefferson's mathematical theory of race and an extended treatment of Appalachia, who is believed to be the first tribe of tri-racial Americans to self-isolate and procreate, creating generations of future Benetton models. She weathers moments of panic. She had the feeling that the book was her last word on something and she had to get it right. There would be no second chances. When she'd sent off the ill-fated script to her unsuspecting agent, she'd allow herself a moment of uncharacteristic bravado. She believed, if only fleetingly, that she had created a man-spreading major American novel. She was going to become the voice of her people. The contrast between Jane's novel, bloated, grandiose, and Cena's well-oiled, precisely choreographed, could not be more apparent. Yet those differences masked a shattered preoccupation. Both novelists, fictional and real, have a great American biracial novel in mind, one that will recuse the mulatto experience from lazy stereotyping, and both fall short, but not necessarily because they are unequal to the task, but because the task, as colored television sets out to demonstrate, is basically impossible and anyway beside the point. Where, after all, is the obvious biracial archetype to either deepen or deconstruct? The tragic mulatto figure is by now an outdated cliché from the pre-civil rights era. Meanwhile, what might have been its replacement, the dream of a post-racial hybrid hero that found its apotheosis in Barack Obama, has proved evanescent. The old radical incentive structures, the benefits and liabilities that accompany being of color, have twisted and collapsed under the weight of polarization, identity politics, and yet progress. Today the world is our oyster. I am one of those mulattoes, and we can rather fully identify as black, biracial, raceless, or for the lightest skin, white. Although not half white, a category that does not exist within Americans' convoluted racial calculus. Instead of attempting to untangle this web of racial alternatives, Cena has embarked on a satire of their identification cause itself. She could hardly be better positioned for such a project. Cena's career, this is her third novel since her much celebrated 1998 debut, Kozika, has been singularly focused on the shifting social and psychological dynamics facing mulatto Americans whose skin, like hers, is light enough to pass for white. I'll insist on this word, mulatto. Google it, and you'll see a warning sign accompanied by the word offensive and dated. Because Cena insists on it, not just in colored television, but throughout her writing. A 1998 essay published in Salon was titled Milano Millennialism and opened with the line, "Strange to wake up and realize you're in style." Sina Riley diagnosed that America has been beset by mulatto fever, a worship of multiracial celebrities and stars, such as Lenny Kravitz, who basked in half-caste glory. She spun out a parodic vision of a mulatto pride march, buttons proclaiming, "Make mulattoes, not war," a t-shirt announcing, "Just human," rambling down unspecified Main Street. "I trailed behind the parade for some miles," Sina wrote, "not quite sure I wanted to join or stay at the heels of this group." Vignette has proved an apt metaphor for Sina's trajectory. Born in 1970 to a white mother and a black Mexican father, both of them caught up in the Black Power movement in racially polarized Boston, she was raised black. No checking other, no halfsies, no in-between. Though often mistaken for Jewish, her mother was in fact of Boston blue blood descent. She grew into skeptical ambivalence about the performative mixedness. Ruffling in the Salon essay, Sina described being a spy among white people and a participant observer in Mulatto Nation, just NM for those in the know, and feeling alternatively curious and nauseated in both roles. Often repelled by her discoveries, she honed a mostly keen and acerbic rather than sad and mopey take on biracialism. Her fiction asked where this mulatto parade is going and why people like her should join it or choose not to in post-civil rights movement America. In her novel, drawing on her useful experience in the turbulent mid-70s, Sina presents a protagonist, Birdie, who molds her identity to the dictates of the moment in which racial characterization was more firmly binary, more black and white. New People, published in 2017, jumps forward two decades, giving us biracial Brooklyn in the 1996. Imagine through the lens of an untethered quadroon, also offensive and dated per Google, named Maria, who can't decide whether to marry her beige and benevolent fiancé or to seek out someone more melanated. Both books play out within the guardrails of this tragic mulatto stereotype, even as they press persistently against its limits. These biracial dramas turn, as they always have turned, on the decision. The psychoanalyst Jacques Lacan argued that people who suffer from hysteria, the outmoded diagnosis with a fraught history, are unconsciously plagued by the question, "Am I a man or a woman?" In this sense, the tragic mulatto is akin to a hysteric, except stymied by the interminable puzzle, "Am I black or white?" The fact that a decision is demanded by a society organized around and deeply neurotic about racial characterizations shapes and fate. Corsica and New People are both saturated, deliberately and deftly, within this racial hysteria. The adolescent Birdie must pick up the comparative case of feigned whiteness or the shared heritage of blackness. Maria must decide whether to become one of the glittering New People of the novelist's title and an in-style mulatto, or embrace old-fashioned blackness with its weight and earned pride. Color television is roughly in the present, appears lightly autobiographical, focusing on a mixed-race novelist dedicated to chronicling mulatto life and hitched to a black artist who refuses to make legibly black art. Sina is married to the iconoclastic black novelist and painter Percival Everett. Yet, as this new novel clicks neatly into place, compelling her historical arc, Sina faces a new challenge. She slips in a different metaphor, clearly meant as a commentary to the current state of the Mulatto Project. Race is like this smoothie here, Hampton says to Jane, holding a cup of green sludge he's drinking as they bat around ideas. This has probably got 5 different fruits and vegetables in it, 6 different supplements, but I couldn't tell you what, because the more ingredients you add to it, the more it tastes like nothing. He puts the straw to his mouth, then remarks, I hate smoothies. A constructive collaboration on what seems destined to be indecipherable racial pulp is evidently not in store. I can make it more biracial, a nervous Jane promises the irascible Hampton as their meetings proceed and her frantic revisionists fail to pass muster. Jane's problem, which is ultimately Cena's problem and America's problem, is if it is a problem, if it's that she doesn't know what mere biracial would even mean. What mulatto essence our racially vampiric entertainment industry is trying to extract from her. Hampton implores Jane to produce a biracial juggernaut, reminding her that his boss hired him to diversify the fucking content. The higher ups are trying to corner the mixed race market, a fast growing demographic in America, but neither he nor Jane has the faintest idea on how to do that. She's kept her platonic rendezvous with Hampton a secret from her high art husband, and the reader is left suspecting that Jane hides the show from Lenny, and not just because he views television writing as a Philistine perversion, but because she would have to explain what her biracial comedy is actually trying to say. Her inability to distill a message from her show is a testament not so much to Jane's insufficient writerly chops as to the challenge of wringing out an unequivocal meaning from biracial America. In a brief but telling moment, Jane sketches out a potential episode for the series during a late night session with Hampton and his assistants, all of them hopped up on Adderall. She proposes that the married mulatto take DNA test. And this, being comedy, she the result surprise. The wife, Sally, discovered she is more American Indian than black, and the husband, Kyle, learns that both his black sides were half Irish. Soon enough, the characters are playing into new stereotypes. Sally starts gambling at casinos, while Kyle develops a drinking problem. Hampton savages the idea, but the aborted episode contains an apt lesson. If these two take DNA tests and promptly turn into Native and Irish caricatures, isn't that a signal that the pre-existing biraciality was never really an identity at all? Cena has a flair for sketching her characters with a kind of thick minimalism, snippets of backstories, and an array of tricks and quips deliver an unexpectedly fully realized person. Jane comes to life on the page, careening among flights of artistic insecurity, California chic fantasies, and the warm banalities of motherhood. She is far more rounded than the walking, talking predicament that she herself has derided. Still, color television can feel like an exercise in shadow boxing. The pacing is brisk, and Cena throws sharp jabs and hooks, but the objects of ridicule are so numerous that they tend to blur. Cena can't resist letting her eyes wander from the tightly drawn critique of identity politics to a series of other equally fashionable sources of ire. Here, she skewers Hollywood with its sellouts and bottomless appetite for lowest common denominator racial profiling. There she takes aim at the American literacy canon, which has too often reduced the mulatto to a tortured soul or sacrificial lamb. She doesn't spare academia with its system of feudal labor that ruthlessly separates anointed tenure and professors from her serf-like contingent labor, or the progressive public with its identitarian fetishes, its class agnostic multiculturalism, and that is all gums and no teeth. Yet the result is seen as broad reach is that she risked a certain flatness. Her project often seems animated by reflexes and of the moment, plummeting familiar targets that were beaten and bruised before she ever laid hands on them. Deft through many scenes are, the novel never quite builds to a truly cutting satire. Color Television is here to tell us that deciding on some tidy new biracial identity to replace the stereotypical tragic mulatto is farcical, futile exercise. You won't find any definitive statements about the mulatto condition post-Civil Rights Act, post-Obama, post-Trump, post-George Flood, George Floyd, and Encina's pages. The mulatto people were a riddle that could never be solved, pronounces a scholar near the end of the novel, having thrown up his hands after a career of trying, earning Jane's enmity at first, and then her empathy. That sentiment is one that some readers might consider a cop-out, but it also delivers a welcome dose of comic humanity. Jane never triumphs with her mulatto War and Peace. Still, a tragic end is out of the question. In a quick, coda-like closing, Cena grants Jane and Lenny an inevitable rescue, which includes scoring a fixer-upper on expensive dirt. And that was Does the World Need a Great American Biracial Novel? By Taylor Austin Harper in the September 2024 issue of The Atlantic Magazine. And we still have a couple minutes left, so I wanted to remind everybody that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is your favorite Sun Sounds of Arizona show, Points of View, and this is the voice of your volunteer reader, Robert Rosen. And I reminded you earlier in the middle of the show, but we have a minute or so here to remind you again that you should download the Sun Sounds of Arizona app onto your tablet, your iPad, or your phone, either iPhone or Android. And it is the link to get to all things Sun Sounds of Arizona. You can get to many, you can get to all everything that's broadcast there. You can get to the live broadcast there. And there's also a lot of other material, books and movies that are interpreted and described as they go, all in that app. And if you want to go back and listen to this show from the top, it's pretty easy. You just scroll down to the entertainment section, and you will find Points of View there that you can stream or download and listen to later. And that will do it for this week's Points of View. It was a pleasure reading for you today, and we will talk to you next week.